Macmillan Audio presents By Heresies Distressed by David Weber. Read for you by Jason Culp. October, Year of God 892. 1. The Temple, City of Zion, the Temple Lands. The snow outside the temple was deep for October, even for the city of Zion, and more fell steadily, thickly, only to be whipped into mad swirls by the bitter wind roaring in off Lake Pei. That wind piled thick slabs of broken lake ice on the bitterly cold shore, swept dancing snow demons through the streets, sculpted knife-edged snowdrifts against every obstruction, and chewed at any exposed skin with icy fangs. Throughout the city, its poorest inhabitants huddled close to any source of warmth they could find. But for far too many, there was precious little of that to be had, and parents shivered, watching the weather and their children with worry-puckered eyes as they thought about the endless 5 days stretching out between them and the half-forgotten dream of springtime's warmth. There was no cold inside the temple, of course. Despite the soaring ceiling of its enormous dome, there weren't even any chilly breezes. The structure, reared by the archangels themselves in the misty dawn of creation, maintained its perfect interior temperature with total disdain for what the merely mortal weather of the world might be inflicting upon its exterior. The luxurious personal suites assigned to the members of the Council of Vicars were all magnificent beyond any mortal dream, but some were even more magnificent than others. The suite assigned to Grand Inquisitor Jaspar Clinton was a case in point. It was a corner apartment on the temple's fifth floor. Two entire sides of its main sitting room and dining room were windows, the miraculous, unbreakable, almost totally invisible windows of the Archangel's handiwork. Windows which were completely transparent from within, yet flashed back exterior sunlight like mirrored walls of finely burnished silver, and which were utterly impervious to the heat or cold which passed through and radiated from windows of mortal glass. Paintings and statuary, all chosen with a connoisseur's exquisite discernment, added their own luxurious beauty to the suite's interior, with its thick carpets, indirect sourceless lighting, and perfect temperature. It was far from the first time Archbishop Willem Reyno had visited the Grand Inquisitor's personal chambers. Reyno was the Archbishop of Changwu in the Harchong Empire. He was also the adjutant of the Order of Schuler, which made him Clinton's executive officer within the Office of Inquisition. As a result, Reyno was privy to far more of Clinton's innermost thought than anyone else, including his colleagues among the Group of Four. Yet there were places inside Clinton where even Reyno had never been, places the Archbishop had never wanted to be.
"Come in, Willem, come in!"
Clinton said expansively, as the temple guardsman always stationed outside his chamber opened the door for Reyno.
"Thank you, Your Grace," Reyno murmured, stepping past the guardsman.
Clinton extended his ring of office, and Reyno bent to kiss it, then straightened and tucked his hands into the voluminous sleeves of his cassock. The remnants of a truly enormous meal lay strewn in ruins across the large dining table, and Reyno carefully avoided noticing that there had been two place settings. Most vicars practiced at least some discretion when it came to entertaining their mistresses within the temple's sacred precincts. Everyone knew it happened anyway, yet there were standards to be maintained, appearances to be satisfied. But Jaspar Clinton wasn't most vicars. He was the Grand Inquisitor, the keeper of Mother Church's conscience, and there were times when even Reyno, who had served him for decades, wondered exactly what passed through his mind. How the same man could be so zealous when it came to rooting out the sins of others, even while he indulged his own.
"Fair's fair, Willem," the Archbishop told himself. "He may be a zealot, and he's definitely self-indulgent, but at least he's not hypocritical among his peers. And he does draw a remarkably sharp line between sins which are merely venial and those which constitute mortal offenses in the eyes of Schuler and God. He can be as irritatingly sanctimonious as anyone you've ever seen, but you've never heard him condemning any of his fellow vicars for weaknesses of the flesh. Spiritual weaknesses, yes, he can be utterly ruthless where they're concerned, but he's remarkably understanding where those perquisites of high office are concerned."
He wondered who tonight's visitor might be. All of Clinton's appetites were huge, and he craved novelty. Indeed, few women could hold his attention for long, and once his interest in them waned, he tended to turn to another with sometimes startling abruptness, although he was never ungenerous when he transferred his interest to another. Reyno, as the Inquisition's adjutant, was well aware that there were those within the temple's hierarchy who disapproved, in some cases strenuously, if quietly, of Clinton's addiction to the pleasures of the flesh. No one was likely to say so openly, of course, and Reyno had very quietly quashed a few reports of condemnatory comments before they ever reached the Grand Inquisitor's ears. Still, it was only natural for there to be a certain unhappiness. Some of it could probably be put down to pure envy, although he was willing to concede that there was genuine disapproval of such sensuality behind much of it. Indeed, there had been times when Reyno had found himself feeling much the same sort of disapproval. But the Archbishop had concluded long ago, even before Clinton was elevated to his present office, that all men had flaws, and that the greater the man, the deeper his flaws were likely to run. If Clinton restricted his particular faults to the pursuit of fleshly pleasure, surely that was far better than what Reyno had observed in the occasional inquisitor who found himself using the cover of his high office to indulge his own taste for unnecessary cruelty.
"Thank you for coming so promptly, Willem," Clinton continued as he ushered the Archbishop to one of the temple's incredibly comfortable chairs. He smiled as he settled Reyno and personally poured him a glass of wine. The Grand Inquisitor's normal table manners generally took second place, or even third, to the gusto he brought to food and wine, yet he could be an incredibly gracious and charming host when he chose to be. Nor was that charm false. It simply never occurred to him to extend it to anyone outside the circle of intimates he relied upon and fully trusted. Or at least trusted as much as he ever trusted anyone else.
"I realize your message didn't seem to indicate any immediate urgency, Your Grace. I had business in the temple to attend to anyway, however, so it seemed best to respond to your summons promptly."
"I only wish I had a dozen archbishops and bishops who were as reliable as you are," Clinton told him. "Langhorne, I'd settle for 6.
Reyno smiled and inclined his head in a small bow, acknowledging the compliment. Then he sat back, nursing his wine glass in both hands while he gazed attentively at his superior. Clinton was looking out the floor-to-ceiling windows at the swirling snow and wind. His expression was almost rapt as he contemplated the icy torrent of white for the better part of 3 minutes. Then, finally, he turned back to Reyno and leaned back in his own chair.
"Well," he said, with the air of someone getting down to business at last, "I'm sure you've read all the reports about the seizures of Carisian merchant ships month before last."
He arched one eyebrow slightly, and Reyno nodded.
Good. I was certain you would have. And since you have, you're undoubtedly aware that there were certain difficulties.
Yes, Your Grace, Reynaud acknowledged as Clinton paused. Of course, the Archbishop was aware that there'd been difficulties. Everyone in Zion was aware of that much. What had been supposed to be an orderly seizure of unarmed, or at least only lightly armed, merchant ships as the first step in closing all mainland ports against the all-pervasive Carizian merchant marine had turned into something else entirely. Not everywhere, perhaps, but what the Grand Inquisitor was pleased to call difficulties was something the Carizians were going to call a massacre when word of August's events in the Kingdom of Delpharax's port city of Ferade reached them. Actually, Reynaud corrected himself, what they're undoubtedly already calling it, given the fact that at least some of their ships got away and most certainly sailed straight to Telisburg. The Archbishop shuddered at the thought of what the schismatic Carizian propagandists were going to do with that many civilian casualties. One thing's for sure, he thought grimly, they aren't going to minimize what happened. And that, Reynaud realized, was what was truly on Clinton's mind. The Grand Inquisitor was speaking less of the fatalities involved than he was of the need to put the proper context on the part the Inquisition had played in the seizures. Few of those seizures had gone as badly awry as the ones in Delpharac, or not, at least in the same way. Personally, Reynaud found the implications of what had happened at Siddar City even more disturbing, in many ways. According to the Inquisition's agents there, everything had been proceeding far more smoothly than in Ferade, right up to the moment, at least, when, for some unknown reason, every Carizian merchant ship had simultaneously decided to expedite its departure. It was undoubtedly a mere coincidence that they'd decided to do that before Lord Protector Gregor had gotten around to formally issuing the orders to implement the Church's instructions to seize them. Of course it was. There was no proof of who'd warned the Carizians, yet whoever it was, it had to have been someone deep in the Lord Protector's confidence. The only real question, in Reynaud's mind, was whether the informant had acted solely on his own, or if Lord Protector Gregor himself had made the decision to betray the Church's trust. Given the fact that his staff had somehow been unable to locate their inexplicably missing head of state and deliver Clinton's instructions to him for at least 12 hours, Reynaud rather suspected that he wouldn't have cared for the answer to his own question if someone had provided it. Whoever the traitor might have been, he hadn't acted entirely alone, no matter whose idea it had been. Siddar City wasn't the only Siddharmachian port where every Carizian merchant ship had mysteriously departed mere hours before they were supposed to be sequestered by the Republic's authorities. The possibilities that suggested were far more unpalatable than a few score of dead Carizian sailors in Ferade. Not that we can expect everyone else on the Council, or even within the Order, to see things that way, Reynaud thought grumpily. The name of Samuel Wilson came forcefully to mind, and the adjutant reminded himself barely in time not to grimace. Not that Clinton would have disagreed with his subordinate's unloving thoughts where Vicar Samuel was concerned. If he decided Reynaud's expression indicated the Archbishop's disapproval of the decision to close the mainland ports to Caris, however, it could have unfortunate consequences.
Well, Clinton said again, grasping the thread of the conversation once more. As you and I have already discussed, it's essential that Mother Church put the true version of events into the hands of the faithful before any Carizian lies can take root there. I believe that may be especially important in this instance.
Of course, Your Grace. How may I be of assistance?
It's taken longer than I could have wished, the Grand Inquisitor told him frankly. But Trinair and Duquerne have just about agreed upon the text of a proclamation setting forth what happened, especially in Farade, and granting martyr's status to those murdered by the Carizians. It's still weaker than I would prefer. It stops short of declaring holy war, for example. I suppose it does set the groundwork for the eventual declaration, but certain parties are still waffling. I think Duquerne actually entertains the belief, or the hope at least, that this can all be patched up somehow. Deep inside, though, even he has to know he's wrong. It's gone too far. The Inquisition and Mother Church simply cannot allow this sort of direct challenge of God's will and his plan for the souls of men to pass unpunished. And the chastisement must be severe, Willem. Severe enough to prevent anyone else from even contemplating ever following in their footsteps. Reyno simply nodded. There was very little new in what Clinton had just said, aside from the confirmation that the proclamation the adjutant had expected for 5 days was approaching readiness. On the other hand, as much as Clinton enjoyed explaining things, it was unlikely he'd recapped all that history without a specific purpose in mind.
I have to confess that the thing which is preying most strongly upon my own mind just now, Willem, isn't those damnable Carizians' open defiance. Oh, obviously that's going to have to be dealt with, but at least Caleb and Stainer were rash enough to come out into the open. They've declared their allegiance to the pernicious doctrines Shun Wei is using to split Mother Church, marked themselves for the Church's justice and God's vengeance. In the fullness of time, they'll receive that justice and vengeance in full measure, too. But what happened in Siddharmark, that's another story entirely, Willem. Someone very highly placed in the Republic's government must have alerted the Carizians. And while I'm fully aware of all the diplomatic niceties which prevent Zamson from coming right out and taxing Gregor with responsibility, there's not much question in my mind as to who bears the responsibility. Even if he didn't give the specific order himself, and I wouldn't bet a mug of flat beer on that possibility, it had to be someone very close to him. And there are no indications he's even remotely close to identifying the culprit, much less punishing him. That sort of insidious rot, the kind that hides behind a facade of loyalty and reverence, is deadly dangerous. Left to itself, hiding in the shadows, the infection will only grow more and more corrupt until we find ourselves with a second, or a third, or even a fourth Church of Caris on our hands.
I understand, Your Grace, Reyno murmured when the Grand Inquisitor paused once more. And the adjutant was beginning to understand, too. Had the culprit in question been found anywhere except in the inner circles of the Siddharmarkian government, Clinton wouldn't simply have been concerned about any future rot. He would have been demanding the head of whoever had done it. Unfortunately, pressing Siddharmark too hard at this particular time was contraindicated. The last thing the Church wanted was to engineer a marriage between Siddharmark's pikemen and Caleb of Caris's navy.
Unfortunately, Clinton continued, as if he'd been reading Reyno's mind, which wasn't something the adjutant was completely prepared to rule out as a possibility.
If Gregor can't, or won't, identify the responsible party, there's very little we can do about it from the outside, for now at least.
I take it from what you've just said that you've been working on a means to change that, Your Grace?
Reyno's tone was merely politely inquisitive, and Clinton snorted a grunting laugh as the adjutant arched his eyebrows delicately.
Actually, I have, he acknowledged, and the fact that Siddharmark is so stubbornly attached to its republican traditions is part of my thinking.
Indeed, Your Grace? This time Reyno cocked his head to the side and crossed his legs as he awaited the Grand Inquisitor's explanation.
"One of the things that makes Gregor so damnably stiff-necked and defiant behind that mask of piety and obedience of his is his belief that the voting citizens of Siddharmark support his policies. And, to give Shan Wei her due, he's pretty much been right about that. That's one of the considerations which has prevented us from turning up the pressure on him the way we really ought to have done long ago. But I rather doubt that public opinion in Siddharmark is quite as firmly united in approval of this schism of Karras's as Gregor may think it is. And if, in fact, his precious voters disapprove of Karras, and of the things he's willing to do behind the scenes in support of the schismatics, then I suspect he'll change his tune."
"That sounds eminently sensible to me, Your Grace," Reyno said, nodding his head. "Exactly how do we reshape that public opinion in our favor, though?"
"Over the next few days," Clinton said, his tone a bit oblique, his eyes once again straying to the white maelstrom of the October blizzard, "several of the Carisians seized when their vessels were impounded will be arriving here in Zion. Actually, they'll be arriving here, at the temple itself."
"Indeed, Your Grace."
"Indeed," Clinton confirmed. "They'll be delivered directly to the Order. To you, Willem."
The Grand Inquisitor's eyes snapped back from the windows, boring suddenly into Reyno's.
"I haven't gone out of my way to mention their impending arrival to the Chancellor or to the Treasurer General. I see no need to disturb them with what are, after all, the Inquisition's internal matters. Do you?"
"Clearly not at this time, Your Grace," Reyno replied, and Clinton smiled again, thinly.
"That was my thinking as well, Willem. What we need to do is to interview these Carisians. Shan Wei is the mother of lies, of course. No doubt she'll do her damnable best to protect these heretics lest they betray her by revealing her plans and perversions to the true children of God. But the Office of Inquisition knows how to strip away Shan Wei's mask and reveal the truth behind it. That will be your task, Willem. I want you to take personal charge of their questioning. It's essential that they confess what actually happened, admit their deliberate provocation of the civil authorities who were simply attempting to peaceably carry out their instructions from Mother Church and their own secular authorities. The world must see clearly where the true blood guilt lies, just as it must learn of the perverse practices and blasphemies which this so-called Church of Karras has embraced, and seeks to enforce upon all the children of God in the name of its own dark mistress. Not only does the redemption of these sinners' own souls hang upon their full confession and repentance, but once the truth is revealed, it will have a powerful effect upon public opinion everywhere, even in Siddharmark."
His eyes continued to bore into Reyno's, and the adjutant drew a deep, steadying breath. The Grand Inquisitor was right about the necessity of confession and repentance, if a soul which had strayed from the path of the archangels was ever to find true redemption. And the Inquisition was accustomed to its stern, often heartbreaking responsibilities. It understood that the true love of the sinner's soul sometimes required that sinner's body be dealt with harshly. It was sadly true that it was often difficult to break into that fortress of self-pride, arrogance, and defiance, and lead the lost soul hiding within it back into the cleansing light of God's love once again. But however difficult the task might be, it was one the Inquisition had learned to discharge long ago.
"How quickly do you need this accomplished, Your Grace?" he asked after a moment.
"As soon as possible, but not instantly," Clinton replied with a shrug. "Until my colleagues are prepared to act openly, I doubt that a confession from Shan Wei herself would carry much weight with anyone who's already prepared to believe the schismatic's lies. And, to be perfectly frank, I expect that Duquesne, at least, is going to express all sorts of pious reservations and protests at the thought of the Inquisition's doing what's necessary in this case. So, for now, this needs to be done very quietly. Keep it within the order and be sure that, even there, you rely only on brothers whose faith and fidelity we know are trustworthy. I need to be able to produce this testimony when the time comes, but in the meantime, we don't need any well-intentioned weaklings who don't understand that in this case, too much kindness would be the worst cruelty of all, getting in the way and hampering our efforts.
I agree with you, of course, Your Grace, Reyno said. However, I do have a tactical reservation, let's say.
What sort of reservation, Willem?
Clinton's eyes had narrowed slightly, but Reyno appeared not to notice as he continued in the same calm, merely thoughtful tone of voice.
Everything you've just said about controlling the time at which this testimony is made public strikes me as completely valid. But you and I are accustomed to dealing with the pragmatic, often unpleasant duties and responsibilities inherent in attempting to reclaim the fallen for Langhorn and God. If, when we obtain the apostate's confessions, some people are going to wonder why we didn't make those confessions public immediately. Some of that questioning will be completely sincere and legitimate from people outside the Office of Inquisition who simply don't understand that sometimes saving the sinner is only the first step in combating a greater evil. But there will also be those, Your Grace, who seize upon any delay as an opportunity to discredit anything we may say. They'll argue that the penitents were coerced, that their confessions aren't reliable.
No doubt you're right, Clinton agreed. In fact, the same thought had occurred to me. But almost as soon as I thought about it, I realized I was worrying unduly.
You were, Your Grace?
Yes, Clinton nodded. I have no doubt that once you've managed to bring these people to the point of confession and repentance, we'll discover that many of the Church of Caris's perversions and abominations are even worse, horrifically worse in some cases, than anything we could reasonably suspect from here. Undoubtedly, as the painstakingly thorough guardian of the truth I've always known you to be, you'll insist on confirming as many as possible of those outrageous claims before making them public. It would never do to suggest such shocking possibilities if, in fact, it later turned out that the heretics had lied to you. So obviously, until we have that confirmation, we couldn't possibly justify presenting our findings to the Council of Vicars, or to the citizens of Siddharmark, who mistakenly believe that Caleb, Stainer, and the others must have at least some valid justifications on their side.
I understand, Your Grace, Reyno said, and he did.
Good, Willem. Excellent. I knew I could trust your diligence and discretion in this matter.
You can, Your Grace, definitely. I suppose the only remaining question I have is whether or not you want progress reports.
Nothing written at this point, I think, Clinton said after thinking for a moment. Written memos have an unfortunate habit of being taken out of context, especially by people who choose to take them that way in order to suit their own purposes. Keep me informed, but verbally. When the time is right, I want to produce as many as possible of the heretics who have confessed. And, of course, I'll want detailed, signed, and witnessed written copies of their confessions as well.
I understand, Your Grace.
Reyno rose and bent to kiss Clinton's ring of office once more.
With all due respect, Your Grace, I think perhaps I should return to my office. I need to do some personnel selection and make certain the brothers I choose fully understand your fears and concerns.
I think that sounds like an excellent idea, Willem, Clinton said, escorting the Archbishop back towards his chamber's door. An excellent idea indeed. And when you make your selections, remember that Shan Wei is cunning. If there should be a chink in the armor of one of your inquisitors, never doubt she'll find it and exploit it. This responsibility is too serious. The potential consequences are too great to let that happen. Be sure that they're fully protected in the armor of the light and girded with the strength of will and purpose and faith to do that which must be done, however grievous the doing of it may seem. Our responsibility is to God, Willem. The approval or disapproval of mere mortal, fallible men cannot be allowed to sway us from the obligation to meet that dreadful responsibility, whatever it may demand of us. As Schuller taught and Langhorne himself confirmed, extremism in the pursuit of godliness can never be a sin.
Yes, Your Grace, Willem Reyno said quietly. I'll see to it that that all of us remember that in the days to come.
November, Year of God 892. 1. City of Farade, Farade Sound, Kingdom of Delpharac. At least the Carizians were extending full military courtesies to their defeated enemies. The thought ran through the back of Sir Vic Lakeyear's mind as he scaled the steep battens on the ship's high side, then stepped through the entry port onto HMS Destroyer's deck. The bosun's pipes, which had twittered painfully and apparently endlessly as he climbed, fell blessedly silent. And the grave-faced young lieutenant, waiting to greet him, touched his right fist to his left shoulder in formal salute. "The Admiral extends his respects and asks you to join him in his day cabin, my lord," the lieutenant said. My, how polite, Lakeyear thought, acutely conscious of the lack of weight where his sword should have hung by his side. Of course, he hadn't seen that sword in the last 2 days. Not since he'd surrendered it to Admiral Rockpoint's senior marine officer. "Thank you, Lieutenant," he said aloud, and the lieutenant inclined his head in a slight bow, then turned to lead the way below. Lakeyear tried not to gawk as they descended from the Carizian ship's upper deck, the spar deck, they called it, to its gun deck. HMS Destroyer was huge. Easily the largest ship he had ever been aboard, although at least one or two of its consorts, anchored off what had once been the waterfront of the city of Farade, looked larger than it was. What was even more impressive than its sheer size, however, was the number and weight of its guns. The short, stubby carronades on the spar deck had been bad enough. The monsters crouching on the gun deck were even worse. There had to be at least 30 of them, and he'd already seen the devastation their 38-pound round shot had wreaked upon the port's defenses. Such as they were, and what there was of them, Lakeyear thought. Sunlight streamed in through the open gun ports, illuminating what was almost certainly, normally, a gloomy cavern. Or perhaps not all that gloomy, he reflected, as he and the lieutenant passed through a brilliantly lit, rectangular pool of light, streaming down through the long, narrow grating of the spar deck main hatch. The smell of burned gunpowder hovered faintly about him, despite the meticulously clean deck, scrubbed bulkheads, and canvas wind scoops rigged to ventilate the ship. The smell was barely there, hovering at the backs of his nostrils, like something suspected more than actually experienced. Or perhaps it was the scent of a more mundane smoke, he reflected,
after all, there was a large enough cloud of that hovering black and dense above the city he'd been charged to protect. Even though the breeze was blowing towards shore, not away from it, the smell of burning wood had accompanied him aboard Destroyer, clinging to the folds of his own clothing, no doubt. They reached a closed door in a light bulkhead which was obviously designed to be taken down when the ship cleared for action. A uniformed Marine stood guard outside it with a bayoneted musket, and the lieutenant reached past him to rap sharply on the door with his knuckles.
"Yes?" a deep voice responded.
"Sir Vic Lakehear is here, my lord," the lieutenant said.
"Then please ask him to come in, Stiven," the deep voice replied.
"Of course, my lord," the lieutenant replied, then opened the door and stepped courteously aside. "My lord," he murmured, and waved gracefully at the doorway.
"Thank you, lieutenant," Lakehear replied, and stepped past him. Lakehear had expected to find his host waiting directly on the other side of that door, but his expectation was disappointed. The lieutenant followed him through the door, managing somehow, Lakehear was never certain afterward just how the young man accomplished it, to steer the visitor while still following a respectful half-pace behind him. Thus steered, Lakehear found himself leading the way across the cabin towards a second door. His eyes were busy, absorbing the furnishings about him, a woman's portrait, smiling at any visitor as he entered, armchairs, a short sofa, a waxed and gleaming dining table with half a dozen chairs, a handsome ivory-faced clock ticking away, a polished wine rack made out of some dark, exotic tropical wood, a glass-fronted cabinet filled with crystal decanters and tulip-shaped glasses. They created a comfortable, welcoming space which only made the intrusion of the massive, carefully secured 38-pounder crouching with its muzzle touching a closed gun port an even greater contrast. The lieutenant followed him through the second door, and Lakehear paused just inside it as he caught sight of the ship's great stern windows. He'd seen them from the boat rowing across the harbor, so he'd already known, intellectually at least, that they stretched the full width of Destroyer's stern. That wasn't quite the same thing as seeing them from the inside, however, he discovered. Glass doors at the center of that vast expanse of windows gave access to a stern walk, which, like the windows themselves, ran the full width of the warship's stern. Indeed, although he couldn't see it from where he stood, the stern walk wrapped around Destroyer's quarter galleys as well. The cabin into which he had just stepped was awash with light, bouncing up and through those windows as it reflected from the harbor's wind-flurried surface, and the man waiting for him was a black silhouette against that brightness.
"Sir Vic Lakehear, my lord," the lieutenant murmured.
"Thank you, Stiven," the dark silhouette said, and stepped forward.
There was something awkward about his gait. Lakehear couldn't quite put his finger on what it was, until the other man stepped clear of the window's brightness, and he saw the wooden peg which had replaced Admiral Rockpoint's lower right leg.
"Sir Vic," Rockpoint said.
"My lord."
Lakehear bowed slightly, and what might have been the ghost of a smile flickered across Rockpoint's mouth. Frankly, Lakehear doubted that was what it had been. Not given the vigor with which Rockpoint had executed the orders he'd been given by Emperor Caleb where Lakehear City was concerned.
"I invited you aboard for a brief conversation before we return to Karis," Rockpoint told him.
"Return, my lord?" Lakehear asked politely.
"Come now, Sir Vic."
Rockpoint shook his head, and this time his smile was more evident.
"We never had any intention of staying, you know. Nor," his smile disappeared, "is there anything worth staying here to keep, is there?"
"Not any longer, my lord."
Lakehear couldn't quite keep the grimness
and the anger out of his tone, and Rockpoint cocked his head to one side.
"I'm not surprised you find the consequences of our little visit less than palatable, Sir Vic. On the other hand, given what happened here in August, I'd say my Emperor showed considerable restraint, wouldn't you?"
A hot, angry retort hovered on Lakeyear's tongue, but he swallowed it unspoken. After all, he could hardly disagree. Rockpoint turned and looked back out the stern windows at the pall of smoke swelling above Farade. More than a third of the city's buildings had helped to feed that looming mushroom shape, but Rockpoint had allowed Lakeyear's surrendered troops to demolish a semicircular firebreak around the portion of Farade he'd been ordered to destroy. Emperor Caleb's instructions had specified that not a building was to be left standing within a 2-mile radius of the Farade waterfront, and Rockpoint had carried out his orders with precision. And also, Lakeyear admitted unwillingly, with compassion. He'd permitted civilians whose homes had lain within the decreed radius of destruction to take away their most prized possessions, assuming they were sufficiently portable, before the torch had been applied. And the Carizian admiral had permitted no excesses on the part of his troops, which, given what had happened to the Carizian merchant crews who'd been slaughtered here in Farade when Vicar Jaspar had ordered their ships seized, was far better than anything for which Lakeyear had dared to hope. "Of course," he thought, regarding Rockpoint steadily, "there's still that interesting little question about exactly what Rockpoint's orders concerning the commander of the garrison who did the slaughtering might be."
"I'm sure most of your citizens will be happy to see the last of us," Rockpoint continued. "I'd like to think that with the passage of time they'll realize we at least tried to kill as few of them as possible. However, there was no way we could allow what happened here to pass unanswered."
"I suppose not, my lord," Lakeyear admitted, and braced himself. The admiral's last sentence suggested he was about to discover precisely what Karis had in mind for the officer whose troops had committed the atrocity which had brought Rockpoint to Farade.
"The real reason I invited you aboard Destroyer, Sir Vic," Rockpoint said, almost as if he had read the Delphirakan's mind, "was to deliver my Emperor's message to your king. This," he gestured with one hand at the smoke-choked vista invisible through the stern windows, "is a part of that message, of course, but it's scarcely all of it."
He paused, waiting, and Lakeyear's nostrils flared. "And the rest of it is, my lord?" he asked finally, obedient to the admiral's expectant silence.
"And the rest of it is, Sir Vic, that we know who actually ordered the seizure of our ships. We know whose agents oversaw that seizure. Neither my Emperor nor Karis is prepared to hold Delphirak blameless over the murder of so many Carizian subjects. Hence this."
He waved at the rising smoke once more.
"Should more of our subjects be murdered elsewhere, be assured Emperor Caleb will respond equally forcefully there as well. Nor will there be any peace between any who attack Karis or Carizians at the orders and behest of corrupt men like Clinton and the rest of the Group of Four. But our true quarrel lies with the men in Zion who choose to pervert and poison God's own church. And that, Sir Vic, is the real reason I asked you aboard. To tell you that although my Emperor must hold you, as any military commander, ultimately responsible for the actions of the men under your command, he understands that what happened here in Farade was neither of your seeking nor what you intended. Which is why you will be returned ashore after our business this morning is concluded to deliver a written message from Emperor Caleb to King James."
"Indeed, my lord." Lakeyear couldn't quite keep the surprise and the relief out of his voice, and Rockpoint snorted in amusement.
No doubt I would have anticipated a rather more unpleasant outcome of this interview if I'd been in your shoes, he said.
But then his expression hardened.
I'm afraid, however, that the unpleasantness isn't quite over yet. Come with me, Sir Vic.
Lakeyear's nerves had tightened once again at Rockpoint's ominous warning. He wanted to ask the Carizian Admiral what he'd meant, but he strongly suspected that he would find out altogether too quickly anyway. And so he followed Rockpoint out of the cabin without speaking. The Admiral ascended the steep ladders to the upper deck with surprising nimbleness, despite his wooden leg. No doubt he'd had plenty of practice, Lakeyear thought, following him up. But then the commander of Farade's defeated garrison found himself standing once again upon the spar deck, and any thought about Rockpoint's agility disappeared abruptly. While the two of them had been below in Rockpoint's cabin, Destroyer's crew had been rigging halters from the ship's yardarms. There were six of them, one dangling from either end of the lowest yard on each of the ship's three masts. As Lakeyear watched, in stunned disbelief, deep-throated drums began to rumble like distant thunder, echoing across mountain peaks. Bare feet pattered and boots clattered and thudded as seamen and marines poured onto their ship's upper decks in answer to that rolling summons. And then six men in priest's cassocks, badged with the purple sword and flame of the Order of Schuler, were dragged across the deck towards the waiting nooses. "My lord," Lakeyear began, but Rockpoint waved his right hand. The gesture was sharp, abrupt, the first truly angry thing Lakeyear had seen out of the Carizian, and it decapitated his nascent protest as cleanly as any sword.
"No, Sir Vic," Rockpoint said harshly. "This is the rest of my Emperor's message, not just to King James, but to those bastards in Zion. We know who provoked this massacre, and we know who ordered it, knowing his minions would do precisely what they in fact did. And those who murder Carizian subjects will answer to Carizian justice, whoever they may be."
Lakeyear swallowed hard, feeling the sweat suddenly beading his hairline. "I never even dreamed of this," he thought. "It never even crossed my mind. Those men are priests. Consecrated priests, servants of Mother Church. They can't just..." But the Carizians not only could, they were actually doing it. And despite his horror at the impiety of what was happening, a part of Sir Vic Lakeyear discovered that he couldn't blame them for it. He saw Father Stiven Gravier, Bishop Ernest Jenkins' intendant, the Office of Inquisition's senior priest in Farade, among the prisoners. Gravier looked stunned, white-faced, horrified. His hands were bound behind him, as were those of the other five inquisitors with him, and his shoulders twisted as his wrists fought against their bonds. He seemed almost unaware of his struggle against the cords as his eyes clung to the waiting noose, and he moved like a man trapped in the bowels of a nightmare. He never dreamed it might come to this either, Lakeyear realized, and yet another emotion flickered through him. He was still too stunned himself to think clearly, but if he hadn't been, he might have been shocked to realize that at least part of what he was feeling was satisfaction. Gravier wasn't the only inquisitor who seemed unable to believe, even now, that this could possibly be happening to them. One of them resisted far more frantically than Gravier, flinging himself against the iron grip of the stone-faced marines, dragging him towards the waiting rope, babbling protests. And as Lakeyear stared at the unbelievable events unfolding before him, he heard the rumble of other drums coming from other ships. He wrenched his eyes away from Destroyer's deck, and his face tightened as he saw more ropes hanging from other ships' yardarms. He didn't try to count them. His shocked mind probably wouldn't have been up to the task anyway.
We interviewed all of the survivors before my Emperor gave us our orders, Sir Vic, Rockpoint said, his harsh voice yanking Lakeir's attention back to him. Before we ever sailed for Farade, we knew whose voices were shouting, Holy Langhorn and No Quarter, when your men came aboard our people's ships. But we didn't rely solely on that testimony when we tried the guilty. It never even crossed Greyvere's mind that anyone else, anyone outside the Office of Inquisition itself, would ever read his secret files. Unfortunately for him, he was wrong. These men were convicted not on the basis of any Carizian's testimony, but on the basis of their own written statements and reports. Statements and reports in which they proudly reported, bragged about, the zeal with which they went about exhorting your troops to kill the heretics.
The Carizian's eyes were colder than northern ice, and Lakeir could physically feel the rage within him, and the iron will which kept that rage leashed and controlled.
Copies of those statements and reports will be provided to King James and to the Council of Vicars in Zion, Rockpoint continued coldly. The originals will be returning to Telesburg with me, so that we can be certain they won't mysteriously disappear. But King James will receive Greyvere's own file copies. What he does with them, whether to publish them abroad, destroy them, or hand them back over to Clinton, is his business, his decision. But whatever he may do, we will do nothing in darkness, unseen by the eyes of men. We will most assuredly publish the evidence, and unlike the men and women, and children they had murdered, Sir Vic, every one of these men was offered the benefit of clergy after he was sentenced, and unlike the children who were slaughtered here on their own ships with their parents, there isn't one of them who doesn't understand exactly why he's about to hang.
Lakeir swallowed hard, and Rockpoint twitched his head in Greyvere's direction.
For centuries, the Inquisition has meted out the Church's punishment. Perhaps there was once a time when that punishment was true justice. But that time has passed, Sir Vic. God doesn't need savagery to show his people what he desires of them, and these men, and others like them, have hidden behind him for far too long, used him to shield them from the consequences of their own monstrous actions, used their office and their authority in the service not of God, or even of God's church, but of vile and corrupt men like Vicar Jaspar. Now it is time they, and everyone like them, discover that the vestments they have perverted will no longer be permitted to protect murderers and torturers from justice. These men never dreamed they might face death for their crimes. They are about to discover differently, and perhaps at least some of their fellow inquisitors will be wise enough to learn from their example.
Lakeir stared at him, then cleared his throat.
My lord, he said hoarsely, think before you do this.
Oh, I assure you, I have thought long and hard, Rockpoint said, his voice as inflexible as his title. And so have my Emperor and my Empress.
But if you do this, the Church...
Sir Vic, the Church sat by and watched when the group of four planned the slaughter of my entire kingdom. The Church has allowed herself to be ruled by men like Jaspar Clinton. The Church has become the true servant of darkness in this world. And deep inside somewhere... all of her priesthood must know that. Well, so do we. Unlike the Church, we will execute only the guilty. And unlike the Inquisition, we refuse to torture in God's name, to extort confessions out of the innocent. But the guilty we will execute, starting here,
starting now."
Lakeir started to say something else, then closed his mouth. "He's not going to change his mind," the Delphorakan thought. "Not any more than I would if I had my king's orders." And, he admitted unwillingly, it's not as if Mother Church hadn't already declared herself Karras's enemy. And he's not wrong about these men's guilt either.
A spasm of something very like terror went through Lakeir on the heels of that last thought, but he couldn't unthink it. It echoed somewhere deep down inside him, reverberating with his own anger, his own disgust, when Greyvir and his fellow Shularites turned what ought to have been, could have been, the bloodless seizure of the Carizian merchantmen here in Farade into bloody massacre. "Perhaps," a tiny little voice said in the shadowed stillness of his heart, "it really is time someone held those who do murder in the Church's name accountable." That was the most terrifying thought of all, for it was pregnant with the dreadful implication of other thoughts, other decisions, looming before not just Sir Vic Lakeir, but every living man and woman. As he watched the nooses being fitted around the necks of the struggling men on HMS Destroyer's upper deck, he knew he was witnessing the seed from which all those other thoughts and decisions would spring. These executions were a declaration that men would be held accountable as men for their actions, that those who extorted murder, who tortured and burned in God's name, would no longer be permitted to hide behind their priestly status. And that was the true iron gauge the Carizian Empire had chosen to fling at the Church of God-awaiting's feet. The last noose went around the last condemned man's neck and drew tight. Two of the priests on Destroyer's deck were frantically trying to fling themselves from side to side, as if they thought they could somehow break free of their rough-edged hempen halters, and it took a pair of marines each to keep them on their feet as the drums gave one last thunderous roar and fell silent at last. Lakeir heard one of the condemned inquisitors still babbling, pleading, but most of the others stood silent, as if they were no longer able to speak, or as if they had finally realized that nothing they could have said could possibly alter what was about to happen. Baron Rockpoint faced them from Destroyer's afterdeck, and his face was hard, his eyes bleak.
"You stand condemned by your own words, your own written reports and statements, of having incited the murder of men and of women and children. God knows, even if we do not, what other atrocities you may have committed, how much other blood may have stained your hands in the service of that man-shaped corruption who wears the robe of the Grand Inquisitor. But you have convicted yourselves of the murders you did here, and that is more than sufficient."
"Blasphemer!"
Greyvir shouted, his voice half-strangled with mingled fury and fear.
"You and all your foul empire will burn in hell forever for shedding the blood of God's own priests."
"Someone may burn in hell for shedding innocent blood," Rockpoint said coldly. "For myself, I will face God's judgment unafraid that the blood on my hands will condemn me in his eyes. Can you say the same, priest?"
"Yes."
Greyvir's voice gusted with passion, yet there was something else in it, something buried in its timbre, Lakeir thought. A note of fear that quailed before something more than the terror of impending death. At least one thin sliver of uncertainty as he found himself on the threshold of mortality. What would he and the other inquisitors discover when they found themselves face to face at last with the Inquisition's victims?
Then I wish you pleasure of your confidence, Rockpoint told Greyvere in an iron-hard voice, and nodded sharply to the parties of seamen who'd tailed onto the ends of the ropes. Carry out the sentence, he said.
2. Merlin Athrawes's cabin, HMS Empress of Caris, Chisholm Sea.
Sergeant!